Well, the Bible reading is Luke chapter 19, verses 1 to 10. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to the house, because this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Lord, may the words of my mouth, the meditation of our hearts, be acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Now, a couple of slides there. Thanks, Rosemary. So, a reminder again, I mentioned last week, this is our journey over the next couple of months, and starting today with Zacchaeus. I'll talk about Zacchaeus probably. There's a couple of ways to say that. But again, these encounters with Jesus and how grace is awakened the people. I want to start today with a reference to the Wizard of Oz movie, The Wizard of Oz. And there's a scene when the four characters finally arrive at the Emerald City. Now, it was a bit hard to find an image where I was confident of the copyright on it, so I thought, oh, look, I'll draw it. So this is me drawing. Now, I know I've got a little work to do, right? And I'm in the presence of greatness when it comes to various artists in the congregation here, but drawn here. Let's see. So starting from the right, who's that? Tin Man. Okay, see, look, I'm doing okay. And next to Tin Man, Dorothy. And down below her, yeah. And then next to Dorothy on the left, yeah. Who's that on the left of on this side of Dorothy? Yeah. Lion. Excellent. Yeah. See, that's not too bad, is it? Yeah. And of course, the wizard up in the corner. This is sort of the scene where they arrive and they're in front of the wizard and they're scared out of their wits. Okay. Now, I thought I'd get a little creative and do a Picasso version of this scene. Okay. When he got a bit older, you know, he got a bit. That's my Picasso, in the style of Picasso. Sorry, I'm being a bit. It must have been a hard week this week because I don't know what's going on. Thanks, Rosemary. Just the next one. And there's this scene. Just back one. Back two. Yeah, there we go. That one there. So in this scene here where they're approaching the great Oz because they have these requests of him that they want to receive something from him. And he says, "The beneficent Oz has every intention of granting your request, but first you must prove yourselves worthy by performing a very small task. Bring me the broomstick of the Witch of the West." And Tin Man says, but if we do that, we'll have to kill her to get it. "Bring me her broomstick and I'll grant your requests. Now go," says the wizard. "You must prove yourself worthy before I will do this for you." Just keep that in mind as we go through this morning, okay? You must prove yourself worthy before I will do this for you. Thanks, Rosemary. Just on to that next one. There we go. So in this passage from Luke's Gospel, Jesus is on the way. Okay, he's on the way. He's passing through Jericho, which is not that far from Jerusalem. And certainly in this part of Luke's Gospel, that's where Jesus is heading. Jesus, in chapter 19, is on his way to Jerusalem here. Luke sets up the scene very succinctly. There was a man there by the name of Zacchaeus. He's a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd, so he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore tree to see him. A very succinct setting of the scene. We have Zacchaeus. He's a chief tax collector. He's wealthy. He's short. Or if we say nowadays, what, height challenged? Something like that. So this is Zacchaeus. Right? And I just want to do some explanations here, which I think are necessary, but also very helpful for what follows. And it's about the Roman taxation system. There were three kinds of duties or taxes within the Roman Empire. There was a land tax, which was a tax on the produce of land. There was what was called a head tax, which was a tax related to a census that would get taken every so often. And the kind of census that we read in Luke chapter 2, and that you would have read that during the week for the seven-week plan. And so a head tax was taken on that. These were both direct taxes. Boy, this is starting to sound like a precursor to Jim Chalmers' budget speech, I know, but anyway. The third tax of the customs system, and it was this long-standing system of tolls and duties that were collected at ports or city gates or other places like that. And these became places where tax collectors would gather, and they would gather this duty, this custom. And tax collectors had the power to determine the value of the tax, and so there was enormous room for fraud, extortion, and injustice. The thing is, these indirect taxes were farmed off to the highest bidder, who had to pay Rome in advance for this tax. So quite often you were already wealthy to be able to do this. You paid a certain amount to Rome and then you could do whatever you want. You could ask whatever you want. As long as you paid that amount to Rome up front, you were then free to do what you wanted to do. It was basically institutional robbery. Something, of course, that would never happen these days. These collectors of this indirect tax are the tax collectors that are mentioned in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So when it talks about tax collectors, these are the ones who are doing this third tax, including Matthew, one of Jesus' followers, was a tax collector. And he's doing his work when Jesus calls him. Okay. These tax collectors were Jews. Okay. They were Jewish people. And a chief tax collector, such as Zacchaeus, was one who supervised other tax collectors. He had reached the pinnacle of his profession. He was at the top of his tree, if you'll pardon the pun. Tax collectors were scorned for their dishonesty and more generally seen as ones who were colluding with Rome. And after explaining all that taxation, I think Anita Beck's in a good lie down, because that's a lot to take on board. But it's really important that we understand that because of what Jesus does, okay? It's clear that tax collectors, when it's used in the gospel, was a derogatory term. We often hear about tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes all in this phrase thrown in together. Fellow Jews, fellow Jews, okay, who were scorned, despised, shunned, ostracized, hated, and shamed. Many rabbis considered unclean the houses that were entered by a tax collector, let alone the house of the tax collector themselves. So we get the picture here of what a tax collector was and how they were viewed. And here is Zacchaeus, a chief tax collector who wanted to see who Jesus was. For whatever reason, he is super, super keen to do that. And there is a sense here that no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get a good view because he was short and because of the crowd, so he climbs a sycamore tree. Now, there's two things that we learn straight away here from Zacchaeus in regards to working out who Jesus is. There's two things that we learn straight off here. And that is, in regards to learning and working out who Jesus is, firstly, we sometimes need to get over our own sense of self-importance. And secondly, to get over those who become obstacles and discovering about Jesus. Zacchaeus climbs a sycamore tree, for crying out loud. He is someone of standing, someone who has achieved so much in his life, someone who, as I said a few moments ago, has reached the pinnacle of his career. He's a chief tax collector, and he clambers up a tree like a seven-year-old kid. Sometimes we need to risk looking a fool in our desire to know Jesus, in our desire to learn more and to grow closer. It takes courage. It takes intestinal fortitude, as we say. It takes the kind of courage that, if you follow the footy, that Canterbury Bankstown Bulldogs have a huge number of Christian people in their team. And I don't know if they do it every game, but often at the end of a game, they'll kneel down on the field and Christians from other teams will come and join them. They'll gather in a circle and they'll pray. That's the kind of courage it takes. It takes the courage, the kind of courage that we saw all those months ago when our friends from Iran walked through that door. It takes the kind of courage that it will take to invite someone to the 3-2-1 Christian faith course that we might just offer beyond our congregation in a couple of months' time. That might just take some courage to invite someone there. Luke continues his account, and Jesus reaches that spot where Zacchaeus is, looks up and says, "Zacchaeus, come down quickly. I must stay at your place today." Now, the sense here is that it wasn't only just lunch, but that Jesus was going to stay with him, that he was going to lodge with him, at least overnight, if not longer than that. Jesus was going to stay with him. And so off they go, and Zacchaeus gladly welcomes Jesus. He receives Jesus with joy. And I love that. This is what we find again and again in Luke's gospel, that the outsider encounters Jesus and Jesus is welcomed joyfully by that outsider, someone who is ostracized. And given what I said earlier about tax collectors, do you see what an extraordinary act this is by Jesus? Well, the crowd certainly do. They start to grumble. In verse 7, all the people saw this and began to mutter, "He's gone to the guest of a sinner." All of them, and presumably his followers as well. It says all of them did. "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But you see, this is what Jesus did. This is what he did. The crowd saw Jesus stop on the way. They see him talk with Zacchaeus. They see Zacchaeus obey Jesus' word to him. Come down quickly, let's go. And they saw him head to his place. And they saw Zacchaeus welcome Jesus. Tax collectors and sinners is the phrase. Now, this series is about grace awakened. And can you see what's happening here in this encounter between Jesus and Zacchaeus? Jesus goes against every societal expectation. In fact, in the face of those expectations, and steps into the home of Zacchaeus, a chief tax collector. That very action is an action of grace. And Zacchaeus responds. He stands up and says a couple of things. It's almost like a vow. First, he'll give half of what he has to the poor, not to his clients or his customers, but to those who are in need. He will give half of what he has. And for those that he might have defrauded, for those that he might have extorted, he will give back four times. The law of Moses said that if that was the case, you needed to give back the amount plus 20%. But Zacchaeus goes over and above that. You know, grace is starting to have its way with him. And he gives back four times as much is what he says that he will do. Whatever the go is here, Zacchaeus is a changed man. He's being confronted by the grace of God as he meets Jesus, and life is not the same for him. William Arndt's commentary, he says this, "With the jubilant trust in divine forgiveness, there has come the grateful resolve to lead a God-pleasing life, to help those in need of help, and to be upright and fair in his dealings." Now, the order of events is really important here. Zacchaeus does not say to Jesus, "I'm going to stop cheating people." And Jesus says to him, "Great, okay, now I'll come to your home and stay there with you." That's not how it happens. You know, that's what the great and powerful Oz said to those four. Oz says to them, "I'll give you what you've come here for, but there's something that you need to do first. You need to prove yourself worthy." That's not what happens in this encounter with Jesus and Zacchaeus. Jesus says, "I'm coming home to you, Zac. I'm coming home to you." And then Zacchaeus makes his speech, makes his response. And so Jesus doesn't say to us, "Look, if you just clean up your act, if you just stop messing around, I'll come and live in you." What we get is what we sang earlier, "Come as you are." Don't run away, shamed and disheartened. Rest in my love, trust me again. Each time you fail to live by my promise, why do you think that I'd love you the less? This is grace, and we respond to that. That's the order. There is a change within us, yes, and Zacchaeus was a changed man, but the order's crucial. The grace of God is extended to us, and we make our response to that. We do not need to prove our worth as Dorothy and her friends needed to do. And Jesus seals it all with his comment, and I want to finish off here. Jesus seals it all with his comment in verse 10, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." To seek and save the lost. And that's one of the key words in Luke's gospel. The least, the last, the lost, and the little. In regards to this word lost, William Barclay says this: "In the New Testament, it simply means in the wrong place. A thing is lost when it has got out of its own place into the wrong place, and we find such a thing, we return it to the place it ought to occupy." End of quote. In the face of the grace of God met in Jesus, Zacchaeus, this son of Abraham, is returned to the right place. and is given a new identity in Jesus. I want to finish today with just a two-minute video of someone who talks a little bit about this. And so just have a look at the screen.
One of the most formative moments in my growing up was actually when I was about 5 years old. And I overheard the words of my kindergarten teacher saying, "This boy," referring to me, "he's not very smart." And I remember as a five-year-old, I didn't really know how to react to that. So like most five-year-olds, I'm clever enough to get by. I just pretended I didn't hear that word, those words, and I just continued, you know, doing my homework, whatever it was. But those words would never leave me, actually. I would grow up for most of my teenage life, and actually up to university, thinking that I was not very smart. And the irony of it is that I did have good grades. I was actually quite a good student, won awards and got scholarships. But every time I won some kind of academic accolade or I did something that was smart, I would think to myself, that's just a fluke, because that's not who you are, you're not smart. Because, you know, when I was 5 years old, I heard those words. And there's something very powerful about your frame of reference, you know, that when something becomes your frame of reference, you see the whole world through that. And that was it for me. Abel's not smart. You know, even if evidence is to the contrary, I just lived out that identity. And there's a very interesting experiment that comes out of a university in the US called the SCAR experiment. Participants were told that they were going to be part of an experiment that studied how the world would respond to them. And the lead researcher told them that she would do three things with them. The first was to draw scars on their cheeks through high quality makeup. She made all their cheeks look like they had scars on them. The second step, the lead researcher showed them reflections of their scars. They were in these places where there were no mirrors, and so she brought out a handheld mirror for them to see it, and then she removed that mirror. And in the third step, the lead researcher told them that she was going to seal those scars so that they would not be removed, but actually, in reality, she was removing those scars. She was actually taking them out so that there would be no more scars on their cheeks. And then she released them from the lab, and she told them to just interact with the people outside of the lab. And so they did that. They spoke to people, they sort of observed how the world was responding to them. They all came back, and then the lead researcher asked them, you know, "What did you think? What was your experience?" And all of them said the same thing. Everyone was more rude to them. Everyone was less polite to them. They were shorter with them. And then interestingly, their third remark was, "Everyone couldn't stop looking at our scars." And I just think there's something profound about how in our humanity, we tend to live out what we believe. Ironically, as easily as those words were said to me by someone who wasn't conscious about the power of their words, another person in my life would say, "Abel, you're actually really good at this." And just like that, the same thing that was said to me was broken because of someone's casual encouragement for me. And I think in a much larger way, God says words of us and to us. And if we would only embrace the truth of what He says about us, what would change about our lives? Like, how would we be transformed by the truth of what He says of us? That we are loved by the Father, that we are sons and daughters of the King, that we are wonderfully made, that we were made with intention and purpose, that we are His royal priesthood, His holy people, that we were set apart to be salt and light of the earth, that we are made for a reason to bring glory to the Most High. If we could live out just some of that truth, what would change about this world? What would change about the people around us? I think that's so powerful because we live out what we believe about our